You're listening to Cairo News Radio Middays.
Welcome to Cairo News Radio Middays. Jack Stein, Spike O'Neill, Mister. How about them Seahawks? Am I right?
How about them? You know, it's funny you say that, my friend. It's funny you say that. You know, we're doing a thing here at Cairo with Doug Baldwin's, a charity here in town. Doug Baldwin, of course, one of the great receivers in Seahawks glory days, along with Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill. And I just saw Michael Bennett in the parking lot. Michael Bennett's a defensive lineman who gave the Seahawks some of their best plays during our best times, the Super Bowl runs. So I and I total fanboyed. I pull in the parking lot and there's Michael Bennett, and I start I'm chewing on my own tongue. I'm like Michael, I got to tell you, I just want to thank you for the greatest football of my life. I'm like, he's like, thanks, that means a lot to me, as he's eyeballing his security, telling him to come between me and Michael Bennett. I get that way with guys that I've admired like that.
You know what I noticed, Spike, is I have friends that are much more successful than I am. They're you could consider them to be famous people.
Everybody should have some of those. Everybody should have friends higher than they are.
What's weird is that I texted a friend of mine. She is a political commentator, and she is – I'm not going to drop any names because I don't – you know what I mean? I don't want her to hear
decorum,
this.
Decorum, nicely done.
I try to be polite with my friends who are higher up in the business than I am. And so I texted her the other day because she tweeted something that was brutal. I mean, she tweeted something that was just a total takedown of this other political commentator that we both have disdain for. And so I took a screenshot of what she tweeted, and then I texted her, and I said, absolutely brutal, happy face. And it has since been, Spike, 4 days, no response.
Ooh.
And I go, are we still friends? Do I call? That's the weird thing about having famous friends is that you go, am I not famous enough? Nick, you know what I'm talking about, right? You got famous friends.
Right down the path, man. I don't know if I can count on my one hand. I think I got like Steven Tyler. We got Bruce Springsteen. I know Spike's favorite.
I know. I follow Nick around just wanting him to introduce me to these people. You know, it's so tough. There's no nuance in texting.
None.
And
you
can be a smile on your face and you put a smiley emoji, right? You're trying to show her it's like, hey, nice takedown.
It
can be so easily misinterpreted.
Right. Yeah. So the way that I try to explain it to people is having famous friends is kind of like how I am friends with a guy who is the former DA for Santa Clara County. And this is a guy who oversaw the worst of the worst in terms of murder cases, you know, premeditated murder, child abuse, kidnapping. The guy was, you know, the elite of the elite when it comes to prosecutors for the state of California. And when you talk to the guy, and you have to be very mindful of what so you can't say like, yeah, so my accountant did some magic for me on my taxes. Do you know what I mean? Monitor your behavior whenever you're around him.
Yes.
And when you tell a story to my buddy, Dave, when you're talking to him, he looks at you like how a litigator looks at you. It's this intensity that he has behind his eyes where you can see that his computer brain, his lawyer brain, has never turned off. And so you feel as if you're being monitored all the time. He's the nicest guy on the planet.
Yeah.
He's a kind of a gentle giant-esque figure. But when you tell the guy a story, you feel like you're in the interrogation room or you're in court and he's about to say, so what you're telling me is that when you went to the Starbucks and you ordered the green tea and you asked for half ice, what was your intention behind that? Were you trying to get more of the beverage for free? It's really bizarre.
Well, folks like that are often have their experiences and their exchanges called into question. Seems innocuous and innocent to us. Did one Jack Stein confess to you his intent to steal product from a major retailer? And
exactly.
Yeah,
his bag fees.
Are we friends here, or am I on the clock?
It's weird because I have a friend of mine who writes for Comedy Central. I have many friends of mine that are higher up political commentators. And so when I chat with them, it's almost like it's just kind of weird. There's a kind of a weird disconnect there because I don't make $3 or $4 million a year yelling at other people about politics, right? I do it on my little radio show with my friends,
and then
I don't go on Fox News. I don't go on. I don't go on CBS. I just hang out with my buddies and we crack wise on the radio. But what my friends do is this high level political maneuvering and jockeying. So everything that they say is so scrutinized and so combed over that everything is so carefully placed that even in common discourse, it's like they're always being monitored and they're always being watched. And there's a weird thing that they have that I don't possess as somebody who just does local radio, right?
Yeah. It's a blessing.
It is.
Not to have to look at every word you say through that lens.
Right. Yeah. And also, you know, for them, it's like, this is why I don't, people are always like, who's your friend? Who's a country star? Who's your friend who talked about, the reason I don't say it is because if I say something on air, I don't want it to reflect on that. Do you know what I mean? Because we're friends and I don't want it to reflect on them. And so you're friends with this guy who thinks blah, blah, blah. So I try to avoid it. Anyway, Spike, speaking of controversial takes, our good friend Jason Rantz over at 770 KTTH, love Jason Rantz, by the way. He wrote this great piece where he is exposing the fact that there are people who have partnered with the city of Seattle who have admitted to funding fentanyl pipes over treatment. And so they're basically doing this system that we've heard time and time and time again called harm reduction.
Right.
But in this case, when they were speaking in front of a council committee hearing, they were asked by Sarah Nelson, basically saying, hey, so you guys are using the harm reduction model, but can you break it down a little bit further? And so these guys are saying that we're using the harm reduction model, but we're not actually the treatment part of it is not necessarily in our goals right now. We're just solely focusing on the harm reduction model. And it's annoying to me as a former drug addict, Spike. It's irritating to me. I understand the philosophy that they're trying to use,
right,
but I feel like it's grossly misplaced. I feel like this idea of, well, we're going to focus first and foremost on harm reduction, and then we'll focus on everything else. I don't see the equation. In the same way that if you know the show on TLC where you have the morbidly obese people who go, it's my 800-pound life, my half-ton life. Have
you seen
that show?
We couldn't come to terms, so I wasn't involved with that show. it still hurts a little bit, still a little too tender. No, I know the show. I know the show.
Right. So in the gist of the show is that these people who are horrifically obese and have eating disorders, they go to see this specialist. And this specialist, every time he says, before I give you the surgery that you want, you have to lose 200 pounds, 300 pounds to show me that you're serious about wanting to lose all this weight because you're a food addict, right?
Right.
If his model was, well, instead of eating 4 or 5 bags of Chips Ahoy, why don't we just cut it down to like the raw cookie dough, right? And then we'll see where you are in 6 months. He doesn't do that, right? Because he knows that that model doesn't work. He just knows that these people have to show that they want to get off of drugs. My intuition about drug addiction, being that I have a PhD in street level drug use, is that these people are effectively enabling these addicts to not actually go into treatment because treatment isn't the goal, as they said themselves at this particular meeting, right?
Right.
They said it's not the goal. The goal is harm reduction. And it's frustrating because they're, I know, Spike, you have a different opinion on this.
I do.
I know that, Matt, you have a different opinion on this as well, where it's, well, we have to look at the infections and hepatitis C and hepatitis B and all this other stuff. And I agree.
Well, full transparency, Matt invested heavily in aluminum foil.
Also this.
Matt wants people to build their own paraphernalia. He's got, I'm sorry, Matt, I had to say
I'm an entrepreneur.
Yeah,
I had
to say
it.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, man. Before I make my state my piece, I'll.
So my concern is basically this. When the goal, when you outwardly admit that the goal is to effectively facilitate and champion drug use, and then once eventually someone comes around and then eventually they'll say, okay, well, now I'm ready to get sober. That is a dangerous model. It's a high wire act. And I don't think that these individuals understand that, even though they work in the field. I think they've been pumped full of so much propaganda on the issue. They don't actually understand what drug addicts need, which is boundaries, which is something that I talk about all the time.
And I do come at it from a different perspective because having raised little kids, it's the fire in front of you. Okay.
Instead of
teaching my little one to potty train, let's at least put her pants back on while she's doing boom boom. Okay. let's harm reduction at the base level. Plus, when you're talking about treatment, we've talked about this so many times, and you're spot on with folks go when they're ready to go. And it's a reluctant sell. Now, I'm sure that the folks who I took issue with Jason's piece on one regard. Okay. And you even quote it when they seek to facilitate and champion drug use.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're seeking to eliminate the immediate danger of infection and unnecessary. I mean, there's people are going to use, and that's a dangerous situation. But if they're going to use and also subject themselves to various diseases and dangers because they're sharing paraphernalia, that's an unnecessary risk in a situation that's necessary because they're addicts. So that's the fire right in front of them.
Right.
They can do some good right then, right there. Plus, it's a much faster, much cheaper solution to throw out safe paraphernalia to these folks with the intent of speaking to them regarding their disease, regarding their options.
It's the word championing that I would take issue with.
I get that they're facilitating drug use, but I get they're facilitating safer drug use.
They're not saying, hey, this is a great idea. You can continue to help about use taking fentanyl for the rest of your life.
How about now?
That's not the message.
So I would be fine. I would be fine with a needle exchange program or a paraphernalia program if there was a 30-day window or a 60-day window.
How do you mean an indefinite? Well, you mean per person you're helping, here's your paraphernalia.
Yeah.
The clock is running.
Right. So if you want to come in and use our safe injection site, and if you want to use our needles, and if you want to use our tinfoil, you have 30 to 60 days of these resources from the state. Otherwise, we're going to cut you off. That's a model that I would sign off on, and I think it's a good model. The problem I have, Spike, is I'll illustrate it in a brief story. I was invited to a Passover dinner about 2 years ago, right? I had never been, so I didn't realize that it was 12 and a half hours long. But I went to a Passover. Have you ever been to Passover?
I have never had the honor.
It is an amazingly beautiful ceremony that is way too long, right? So we sing the songs, and you go through the trials and tribulations of the Israelites, and it's, you know, there's a person who facilitates this conversation, and there was a guy there who was at this particular dinner, and he's a therapist. He's also Jewish because it's Passover, and he's there in his traditional Passover garb.
Okay. You know what I mean?
And so I'm talking to this guy who's dressed in basically Orthodox Jewish clothing, and he's a therapist, and he is explaining to me how the model that he believes that we should have with drug addicts is that they need clean drugs. And so because he's a hyper-lib, and so he was saying that the government should be making and manufacturing, quote-unquote, clean drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, so on and so forth, and that they should be distributing it to these drug addicts in the same way that they give out, you know, Meals on Wheels.
Sure.
But this is meth on wheels.
Wow.
Right. So they bring it to your house and they drop it off. And then you, when you're ready, that's when you go into treatment, but only when you decide on your terms that you are ready to go. Now, this is a guy who I think he was in his 60s at this point in time. He'd been a therapist for 35 years.
Wow.
In his professional opinion, he thought that that was the best model. Now, has he ever been an addict? No. Has he ever dealt with drug addiction personally himself? No. In his family? No. But his clinical experience tells him that this works. From my perspective, as someone who's been boots on the ground, it's basically like talking to somebody who, I don't know, the difference is someone who is actually in World War II versus someone who watched a lot of John Wayne movies. Do you know what I mean?
That's a great analogy. I hear you. I've seen tons. I mentioned the other day, I've seen tons of, you know, New Jack City type movies. I know nothing about the community.
Right. So I'll tell you this story, man. My grandfather told me, my grandfather was in World War II, and he went out to dinner with a bunch of his boys in the mid-50s, and everybody at the table had served except for this one guy. And for whatever reason, this one guy wanted to talk about combat and World War II and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so this one guy starts just ripping into Patton for some reason. I don't know why. He starts ripping into General Patton. And one of the guys stands up and walks across the dinner table over to the guy, picks him up by his shirt, slugs him one, drags him out of the restaurant, throws him out. But he was so, I guess the guy was so mouthy. And I guess this is the way that men used to hang out back in the 50s. But
sure.
This is besides the point. My point is I feel like that guy when I listen to other people say, hey, we're just going to be giving out drugs and needles and whatnot, and it'll be great. And when they're ready, they're ready. I'm like, I've been in the trenches. I've been there. You haven't. I know what's going on. You don't. So that's the way I feel about it. So that's where my bias comes from.
But let's drill down to this question. I'm curious. You may have the answer to this. Do most overdose or drug deaths occur because of cut drugs or not?
Okay. So most people who are addicts know how to dose themselves. And I mean, no one will tell you this, right? They'll always talk about the one person who found that one pill that they OD'd on. Most drug addicts know how to dose themselves. Rarely do they not understand how powerful a drug is. They OD because their bodies are failing on them and they miss some aspect of their routine. They don't eat that day. They don't drink enough water that day. That's where you get most of these people ODing, right?
Yeah.
Or they are baby drug addicts who've been drug addicts for like a year or two, and they are trying to push the limits of their addiction. Hardcore drug addicts like myself, you know what your dosage is. You know approximately what you need, where the line is, because you don't want to OD, because ODing is lame, because then you're not high. You're ODing. You're dying.
That's
right?
Not a fun day.
It's a bad day.
I think what Matt was asking, maybe I misunderstood.
Sure.
I guess what percentage of overdoses or deaths are caused by contaminated dirty drugs?
I wouldn't know.
I think that was the thought process, because if this clergy / therapist is trying, I mean, addicts are going to be addicts and they're going to find their drugs until they're ready to be clean. If we can take the garbage out of the food chain, if you pardon my pun, for users, and it's the same way for me with clean injection sites and clean paraphernalia. If we can take that additional danger out until they're ready to get clean, it's got to be doing some good.
I mean, we'll continue this debate. I think that's the best way to do it. We'll continue the conversation, but I highly recommend people go read the piece over at My Northwest. Jason Rantz, Seattle Partners Admit to Funding Paraphernalia Over Treatment. We'll take a really quick break. When we get back, we're going to be doing our new segment, Devil's Advocate, where I advocate for a concept that I disagree with. Bus drivers are striking. Should they be? I will tell you why they should not be when we get back right after this. So, Seattle school bus drivers have decided to authorize a strike. They say, we don't cross picket lines. They work for a company that provides districts with bus drivers called Zoom, I believe that we pronounce it.
Yeah, it's Zoom. It's a first year that they've been working for Seattle schools.
I remember this, yeah, because the other provider was hiring people that were, let us just say, not up to the task, correct? So the last provider was kind of like, maybe they were looking over some background checks, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, they were. I don't mean to demean any bus driver. It's a brutal, thankless job for most of the time. I mean, my brother drove a school bus for just a couple years.
Right.
And he will never, ever go back.
Yeah.
He would rather put on a beaver costume and chew through logs for money than go back to driving a school bus. But Zoom is the company that has like an app, much like an Uber has.
Okay.
It's very technologically advanced over First Student, which is the base provider for Seattle schools. Zoom was hired to pick up some of the routes because, like you said, First Student couldn't fill the need for so many drivers.
So about 95% of the 150 drivers employed by Zoom said that they would walk off the job if they do not come to terms on a new labor agreement. The Teamsters Local 174. Good old Teamsters. Am I right? Jimmy Hoffa.
I'm loving them Teamsters, buddy.
which represents the bus drivers, said that Zoom is dragging its feet on a new contract. So, Spike, this segment's called Devil's Advocate because I will advocate on a position which is the opposite position that I would normally take. And so, for as much as I think that these bus drivers should probably just stop complaining and get behind the wheel of a bus and drive the kids, I will take the position that I normally don't take. I think that if a bunch of people agree to strike, then fine, you guys go and strike, right? I got no issue with that. But I will now be taking the position of somebody, I think that they should cross the picket line. Yeah, I think that it's good to do that. And so we shall be playing the game devil's advocate again, where I take a position that I do not agree with, but I will be advocating for it anyway, because it is a good mental exercise. Are we ready to begin?
Sure. And it's always good to see the other side of the argument's right. point of view.
Exactly. Always. Okay, so...
drive a mile in their boots.
Matt, do you want to start us off? I shall be playing the villain today.
Okay, so these people picketing are picketing for your rights if you're a fellow worker. Mm-hmm. If you cross that line, you're mm-hmm. setting up an adversarial working relationship for the rest of your career there. Why is it worth it?
Because when you cross the picket line, you are showing your fellow bus the people there. You're actually, you know what you're doing is that you're showing the company that you are a worthwhile employee. You see, what you're doing is you're saying, I've got the gumption. I've got the ability. I've got the know-how. These guys are losers. And so by me crossing the picket line, I'm a worthwhile employee. And maybe they pay you more as a result of that, right? Independent bargaining. This is what I'm saying. You have to leverage your position. You have to be a double agent. You have to be winking and nodding at the union and saying, yeah, you guys are totally right.
This I got your back. Now I'm climbing over your back to advance myself right. up the corporate
right.
ladder.
Right, exactly.
Ain't that America?
You need to take lemons and make lemonade, right? A strike is a bunch of lemons. You're not getting paid. You're just standing on the side of the road. Hey, we won't go. But you need to leverage this to your own ascendance within the corporate ladder. And so you got, hey guys, I got to go down to Subway. Anybody want some sandwiches? You have to be like,
wait. Yeah.
You have to be like, what's his name from Jurassic Park? Remember the scene in Jurassic Park when Newman is like,
oh, he's like, it's Dodson. Dodson. Nobody cares.
Yeah. But the scene where he's like, anybody want a soda? I had a bunch of salty snacks. I'm just going to go down to the vending machine. Oh,
you get under the ruse of a free lunch, you're going to go in and drive a bus for 3 hours.
Right.
Yeah, somebody was jammed, man. Sorry.
Exactly. Exactly. And what you're doing there is you're taking care of number one. You're taking care of yourself. And that's why you need to cross a picket line. And also, you got bills to pay. Netflix isn't cheap. And so you got to go. And you got to take care of number one. And so that's why I think that crossing a picket line is very good.
I got a lot of people borrowing my password I have to provide for.
Yeah, here. At least so, five. So let me ask you this, Jack, as devil's advocate for this position. When drivers strike, they are withholding service so that the company will have to come to the table. Mm-hmm. When you cross the picket line, you're destroying their leverage. They don't have to come to the table. They've got people driving. What do you say to that?
Well, because it's not about you got to think about this in terms of people say workers of the world unite, right? Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. say that, and this is the only way to get a seat at the bargaining table. Well, if you're the only one showing up to dinner, who's going to get the free bread? You know what I'm saying, Spike?
Yeah, your seat's secure.
If you're showing up to dinner to negotiate and you're the person, that's what I'm saying, Spike, is that you have to individuate yourself from the lemmings over there, from the anchovies, and you have to be a shark. And sharks don't stand on the side of the road with a sign that says, hey, we won't go. Sharks get what's owed to them, right? We've all seen Jaws.
Sure.
And so you go.
Sharks get kids home.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you go and you be a shark and you negotiate for yourself over these people. And when you do get that awesome deal, when you get your own contract and everybody else says, hey, man, how'd you get that sweet contract? You say, well, you should have been working. You should have been driving a bus and proving your worth to the company rather than standing on the side of the road eating Little Caesars, right?
Right. And now that I have a position of power, I will get you guys a sweeter deal. Exactly. I will go to work for you, picketers.
Exactly.
Because they trust me. They respect me. I drove.
Is this pretty solid logic, right? Everybody agrees
sure.
with me?
I mean, if we were going down on the Titanic together and you were the guy who fought your way over the ladies and kids boat, you're the survivor. You're the survivor. You're the one that's going to go build a brave new world.
It's very Darwinian. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I can have all the chivalry while I freeze to death next to Jack, next to the headboard.
Well, and this is the other problem with union. I'm not against union. I'm not an anti-union guy. But the problem with the union is, what if I'm happy with the amount of money I'm making? What if I like the deal? What if I like what I'm getting from the company? And there's a bunch of people who say, we can get more. And I say to myself, I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm a member of the union, I think we have a great deal. I think it's fine. And also, should we really be paying bus drivers that much? No offense to people who drive buses. But it's not a city bus, right? It's you got a bunch of kids. And if we can't find anybody to fill those jobs, there's a bunch of senior citizens out there that will whip those kids into shape.
Dude,
so fast.
Spend one day on your average school bus, you will want to raise. You will understand completely.
No, I'm saying you get some guys or some ladies out there that have retired.
Some of those World War II vets Jack was talking about earlier.
Oh, right, yeah, throw them off the bus.
Yeah.
I've been to Iwo Jima, son. You'll sit.
Hard left turn.
It'll be like that scene in Point Break when Gary Busey was like, I was taking shrapnel and caisson. You remember that scene? whenever I get an Uber, I notice that the people who are driving are the best drivers that I get are the retired people. The people who are retired and they're just driving for funsies.
Yeah.
Pick up a couple of extra bucks.
I've noticed.
I love talking to those people. So you get some of those guys and gals and you put them on a bus and you put them in groups of two or three so that they can kind of rotate around. We'll solve this problem in a day, right? But anyway.
Yeah, all the kids get to school crying and sobbing. You get talking about Normandy. He lost his friend.
All right, we'll take a really quick break. When we get back, Diamond Dave Ross from Seattle's Morning News had a piece on graffiti, and I could not agree more with him on this particular issue. But at the same time, I have a slight disagreement with Diamond Dave Ross about graffiti and what it means to the great city of Seattle when we get back right after this. So Diamond Dave Ross of Seattle's Morning News, always a gem, has an opinion piece over at MyNorthwest.com where he talks about how he gets out of work, goes over to the gym. I don't know if you know this about Diamond Dave Ross, but when he takes off his shirt, he looks like Schwarzenegger in Twins. Remember that scene in Twins?
Yeah.
Diamond Dave.
Okay.
He's very, very vascular is Diamond Dave Ross. He's got really good structure, really good muscles, good genes is Dave Ross. So he goes down to the gym, and when he's going down to the gym, he says he's going down. He looks at the construction down the waterfront, and he starts looking at the viaduct that's being torn down. And he goes, look at this graffiti. Look at this thing there that says Sigma. It's a big piece. It's a huge piece, right? I mean, have you seen this thing, Spike? It's gargantuan.
Stigma. Yeah, yeah.
Stigma.
And
okay,
that's everywhere. That particular tagger, because I don't even want to say artist. That tagger's everywhere in town.
Yeah, and so Diamond Dave Ross basically saying, like, this is really hideous. This is really ugly. And I agree with the guy. I think that one of the biggest problems that Seattle has, it seems like a little problem, I think it's a big problem, is the amount of graffiti that's all over the place. Gross, nasty graffiti that's not necessarily urban street art. I would be fine with it if it was urban art. And what I mean by urban art is when people go out and they make murals that are tasteful, right? Surrealist or kind of out there. I'm fine with it. I think that it adds to the eccentricity of a city. What I'm not fine with, though, are these like just kind of boring, this like tagging culture, this like tagging subculture that's out there where they're trying to signify or signal to their friends that, like, look at what I did in this public space. I think it's pretty gross. I'm not so keen on signing off on it, but I would like to see maybe more of an initiative from that community to move away from this kind of like, I'm going to put my name so that everybody knows that I'm super elite, super based tagger, and more of an effort towards actually making art versus, I would not consider this to be art. I realize that art is in the eye of the beholder, but when I look at this, I just go, this is like subculture, tagging culture. Look at where I can put my name or my, it's not even their name. It's
their handle? I don't even know what to call it.
It's my handle, right?
We had a thing about a month and a half ago where some of the city's public restrooms in our parks were being vandalized and tagged. And it was, from what the reporting said, it was gang related, that they were marking territories.
Yeah, they are. That's part of it. That is
so,
for sure part
yeah,
of it.
I mean, if we can encourage gangs to be more artistic, I don't know how we're going to get around that.
No, I don't know, man. That could be part of it. I mean, Diamond Dave Ross also says, you know, you could put a mural up there. You could commission a mural. But the problem with that is that the tagging culture says, if I see somebody else's art, I put my handle on that art, right? So what you have to do is it has to be a cultural shift from the guys in the tagging community who have to be like gangs in the late 70s, early 80s who say, okay, well, instead of stabbing and shooting each other, we're going to break dance. Remember break dancing? Remember
yes,
break it?
Yes.
We're going to break dance instead. And we're going to show how cool we are at dancing. It basically has to be like that, where instead of just going around and putting up your boring handle all over the place, you put up something that has actual artistic merit or value. And then you have to say, if you're another tagger out there, you have to not then go and be insulted by that person's art, and you have to leave it alone. Right? But that's a kind of a heavy lift. But that's the way that I would do it, is I would go to these guys and say, listen, a black and white bubble text of your name is a little 2001. Yeah, it's a little gauche. It's a little passe, right? Maybe we should try to upgrade our artistic endeavor.
Raise your game, guys.
Raise your game.
Do you ever see when schools have like a really famous part in their school's community, a big rock, and every year the seniors go and they paint their year on it? It changes year after year, right?
Yeah.
What if much like, I mean, your cardboard from breakdancing inspired me. What if next to every big piece of concrete wall where there's a beautiful mural, you put a rock there? And the tagger can tag the rock, and somebody else can tag over their name on that rock. It's kind of like capture the flag.
Yeah.
Because tagger's going to tag, right?
Right. I think they just have to change the way that they view their subculture, which is, in my mind, is their subculture now is about, it's so inward, it's so insular, you know, and the language that they use to signify.
By them, for them.
By them, for them. It's this weird little subculture that's not really cool. It's just kind of annoying. Like roller derby is a cool subculture, right?
Sure.
Punk rock is a cool subculture.
Yes.
Putting your name on a piece of concrete in lettering that a seventh grade girl could do is embarrassing. And I'm just saying it outright, man. I mean, it's just not.
It doesn't add to our city's value, as Dave said in the piece.
It doesn't, man. And I think Dave is totally right about it. Now, but Dave had a really interesting idea. He said, put up ivy, right? Put ivy, put plants up, make it something that can actually be looked at. I think that would go very far in improving the city in general, is if you tried to take the city's assets and really worked to get rid of the blight that we see all over the place. I think that would be very based indeed.